and then another to talk about a rural population which is both emotionally and culturally isolated to the extent of having extraordinary difficulty not merely grasping the precepts of Anglo-Saxon law and the American outgrowth thereof, but of even being able to grasp certain kinds of concepts that we take for granted as underpinning Anglo-Saxon law, and being unable to deal effectively with the whole business of confrontation, which is, of course, what a court system is, a series of confrontations. And that we have to accept that we are in a transitional period, and that perhaps magistrates and conciliation boards are useful transitional devices. But if we were to assume that Alaska's natives are full American citizens, and citizens of Alaska in the fullest sense, they obviously must be served by the highest quality kinds of justice possible. This puts an extraordinary burden on the rest of us to understand the need for very high expenditures for dealing with problems in the bush, because they are going to be high. It also means that many things that seem now politically palatable are probably going to have to be looked at more realistically as not really palatable in the justice system. We've talked here about the merit system that exists in Alaska. It's an excellent idea. In fact, it is almost a unique one. I come from the state of Missouri. We've talked about the Missouri plan. But regardless of what the Missouri plan is, everybody knows in Kansas City and St. Louis that the judiciary is not continuing to come into it. Merit system is a keenly important thing. On the other hand, if we make decisions that people are going to be appointed to judicial positions in the bush, whether it's either magistrate or district court positions, simply on the basis of the fact that they are Eskimos or Indians or belong to some sub-ethnic group, and we're doing a gross disservice both to our sense of racial equality in the United States and the equality under our Constitution, and even grosser injustice to the merit system. Until, if and when, more substantial numbers of people in such communities have reached levels of education and compatibility with contemporary American justice systems, so that they can be selected from for magistrates and or for district judges, with some hope that there will be a high level of quality produced. Presently, the qualities are extremely variable among magistrates. I think everybody who has to deal with them knows it. Everybody knows personally who are the good ones and who are the bad ones. But there are a large number of bad ones. This is a serious problem. It's a problem that is not well addressed by avoidance and should really be dealt with directly. This is, as I indicated, a transitional period. Perhaps the point will come down the road when there will be the possibility of getting from any particular population of the state a sizable number of people who are qualified enough to act in judicial office. That point has not been reached presently. It does not appear to be able to be reached within the next 20 or 30 years. I say that advisedly, so that I think continued decisions about appointments of people on the basis of their ethnic group affiliation are disastrous to the justice system. I would say that at least one thing should be considered quite seriously. To reconsider the possibility for itinerant, either superior or district court systems, and to increase the itinerant movement of such positions so that more communities can be served. But clearly, they should be served by the highest quality people possible. Okay, that's all I want to say.
Judge Buckaloo, you have been an Alaskan lawyer for many years, and you were a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, and a number of the points raised stimulated you to ask questions and make remarks. I wonder if you'd like to make any remarks on the intent of the founders and what's going on.
I enjoyed this last presentation, but I have one question. When we get down to the level that you were saying, I just wondered if they're not putting too much stress and importance on education, because what you're talking about is substantial justice.
No, I'm not. I am talking about substantial justice. I don't think I'm putting too much weight on education. I think that there are underlying things that presuppose a capacity for education, which are even more seriously deficient in many rural communities. We're not talking about communities where children are raised to develop strong achievement motivation, the capacity to internalize certain aspects of control, personal control, or communities in which people are motivated to manipulating abstract concepts. These are not the things that people are raised to expect to do. When you don't raise a child to expect to do that, it really doesn't matter what you do with them in school. He never really does as well on these kinds of things in school. But it's not simply a question of education. It's a question of the weight that we have to put in, necessarily a long weight, to see socialization patterns for children change to the point that where the educational system can actually pick up on these changes and develop people who are able to deal very realistically and effectively with contemporary life. This is not going to happen very quickly. I don't believe that people who have not achieved that level of confidence make very good justices of any kind, in part because the peculiar personality and cognitive characteristics of that kind of population are a need to avoid conflict and a need to try to recharacterize everything in restitutive terms that isn't possible always to do with serious problems. And a tough kid almost always simply papers over problems.
I have a few comments that I'd like to make, and I do this with some trepidation because when I stated a point previously in somewhat exaggerated terms to stimulate discussion, I got jumped all over by the Supreme Court.
Rightfully so.
I'll venture a few comments anyway. The problems, I think, of traveling judges versus resident judges in areas that don't really have enough judicial business to justify the cost of resident judges are very, very complicated. And the more you think of them and the more you look at what experience we've had, the more complicated they are. In theory, as airplane routes are improved and air travel gets faster and faster, and as the cost of air travel, I think, probably gets smaller in relation to the other costs involved, like salary and construction expenses of court buildings, traveling judges are pretty cheap. However, judges have wives and children and houses, and they like to be home at night, and they don't enjoy standing online at 6 in the morning for an airplane any more than anybody else.
We can make that all illegal.
I think that we've had some experience in a state that even though people can travel in theory, they don't, because they're human beings. I think the federal court system is the most notorious example of this among lawyers. Most lawyers regard us in Fairbanks as, for practical purposes, not having a federal court system. Federal law is not used. Cases are not brought in federal court, even when they could be, except on very rare occasions, and often for tactical reasons having to do with the lack of judicial service by the federal government here and the likelihood that your case will never come to trial and there'll be a great deal of delay during which you can negotiate. The federal court continually gets the local bar here to support one thing or another in return for an understanding that the next federal judge will live in Fairbanks, but he never does. They can always hop on a plane and get up here in 40 minutes, but they don't. I think that the fact that they have a lot of work on their desk in Anchorage, the fact that, as I mentioned before, they don't like being away from their families and standing in line on airports any more than the rest of us, contribute to that. Even though it may make a lot of sense in theory to say judges ought to travel, to some extent it may limit us to judges who are bachelors or are having family problems if we turn exclusively to that means. But I have the same discomfort that Art Hitler does with judges who really don't know anything about the law they're trying to apply. If you think that the idea of a judge is not just to do what he feels like doing, but to apply the law, then he has to be somebody who knows the law. And that does require some minimum of education in it. So I think that the success of some of our magistrates, well, I'm thinking particularly of Ed Crutchfield, a Delta magistrate, who I think in the eyes of most of the lawyers who appear before him is just as good as a lot of district judges. He owns a gas station down there, but he's real serious about being a magistrate, and he's taken the trouble to read the law and work on it, and my gosh, he's as good as the district judge that went to school in it. for applying it. Does a real good job, but a lot of magistrates don't know the law, and they may apply some justice that's appropriate, but it may not be the law. It's really a hard problem, and I'm impressed with Art's idea of using these conciliation boards. Another point that I'd like to make is that I think that the problem of judicial selection and the role of politics is a little more complicated than it's been made out to be. Politics is by no means eliminated when you have a judicial council selecting nominees and the governor choosing among the nominees. I think that the role of politics has changed. Instead of working your way up through the Democratic or Republican Party to get a judgeship, it helps a lot to know somebody and know somebody who's a good friend of the governor's. However, this is not to say that it's no better. I think it's vastly better than any other system that we know of in the United States for selecting judges. And the reason is that nomination by the judicial council, while it's not enough to get you a judgeship, is a prerequisite for getting a judgeship. And the judicial council, while it cannot assure by any means that the most meritorious nominee gets the job, it can assure that the real duds are screened out. And it has done that, and it's done a wonderful job of it. But to think that there are no politics at all involved in becoming a judge is to oversimplify a bit. Justice Rabinowitz suggested that the reason that distinguished members of the private bar don't apply for judgeships is a prejudice against public service and the fact that private practitioners make too much money. Well, I don't think that's all there is to it.
Right.
Perhaps that's an oversimplification of the remarks, but that's what I picked up.
I'll grant you that.
I picked up the same thing.
Miller picked up the same thing. Judicial salaries used to be abysmally low here, but they aren't anymore, particularly when you consider the security and the fringe benefits and the fact that the check comes every month and you don't have to worry about collecting and the retirement. They compare very well with what successful private practitioners make. There are many reasons why people don't apply for judgeships besides the money. A lot of people don't want to be judges. I had some experience as a very low-level judicial officer. I was United States magistrate in Fairbanks for 3 years, and it was a lot less interesting and fun than my private practice of law. It didn't pay very well either. I was getting, I think, $5,500 a year, but it wasn't all that bad. It was part-time job, and I could keep the time down, so I wasn't losing too much money on it, but it just wasn't as interesting as my private practice, so I quit. A lot of lawyers don't want to be judges. They just find the work they're doing as lawyers more interesting, more satisfying than the work they think they'd be doing as judges. Now, I think that problem goes down as the level of judgeship goes up. You have a lot of problem getting top-notch lawyers to apply for the lowest level courts, and a lot less problem as the level of the court and the interest of the work gets higher. And there are other reasons too. For example, often it's pretty common knowledge in the private bar that one particular lawyer has it wired, that if he gets through the judicial council, he is going to get the spot. And he's well enough regarded so that he's pretty sure to do well in the bar poll, and there'd be no reason for the council to screen him out as a dud, because he isn't a dud. So there's no reason for anyone else to put in for it, really, unless they want to be the second nominee, who doesn't get it, but whom the judicial council needs to send up. It's also very hard when you're in private practice to stop. If you're at all successful in private practice, you have a lot of cases pending, and you have a lot of backlog, and it's really hard to get off the train. It's a tremendous amount of work just to get somebody else to pick up your cases and to close out your cases and do something responsible with your files. You can't just leave your clients hanging there. There are a lot of reasons other than money why people make decisions about whether to apply for judgeship. With respect to retention elections, I think that there's been some feeling expressed that they have not really served a useful function. The only judge I can think of who ever got bounced by a retention election was Justice Aaron, and that was probably a result of the bar fight and Chief Justice Nesbitt. If you read Justice Aaron's Supreme Court opinions, they're really pretty sound. He was a good lawyer and a good writer of Supreme Court opinions. The real duds, the people who've been judged unqualified by the Judicial Council and the bar, have not been bound by the electorate. Sometimes we feel that when the bar and the Judicial Council tells the public that we think a judge is unqualified, it functions like an endorsement. As people figure, if the lawyers are against them, he must be great. And our approval may be the kiss of death. The retention elections have not functioned that well. And I think that part of this just has to do with the nature of judicial business. One reason why people aren't packing the courtrooms is that the courts are operating quite satisfactorily in this state. Another is that most of the business of courts is of no interest whatever to anybody except the litigants, the people before the court. There is no reason except an exaggerated taste for gossip for anybody except the lawyers and the parties to watch a custody fight or a divorce trial. There's not a great deal of reason for most people to want to watch what happens in a civil case involving an automobile accident. Judicial business, by and large, is an area where decisions are of tremendous importance. They frequently mean wealth or ruin to the people before the court, and of no importance whatever, at least directly. Of course, there's indirect effects on insurance premiums and this sort of thing, but the direct effects on most people are so slight that there's no reason for them to watch, no reason for newspaper reporters to report, no reason for the public to know anything. So the public doesn't know anything about what's going on in the court. And there's not much reason for them to. A fellow who puts up sheetrock for a living has a lot more reason to concern himself with sheetrock and developments in the sheetrock and contracting business than with what's going on in Superior Court. It's not interesting to him, and for good reason. He has more important things from the perspective of his own life to concern himself with. And because of this ignorance, and it's not a bad ignorance, it's a rational ignorance, there's no reason why he's going to know who to vote for in a retention election. I think that, well, one difficulty really in putting together a seminar on the judiciary article, well, my feeling on retention elections, incidentally, is that the Commission on Judicial Qualifications is potentially a much more valuable instrument for screening out judges who become alcoholics or senile or physically or mentally incompetent in some way than elections will ever be. One of the difficulties in putting together this seminar is that when you ask lawyers and judges about the judicial article, the first thing that almost everyone says is that, gee, well, I can't think of much to say about it. If I were writing it today, I'd write it the same way. It's a beautiful constitutional article. It's worked out beautifully. We've got maybe the best judicial system in the United States. There's never been so much as a whiff of the kind of corruption that you find in so many other states. It's really a great system. I think that we should be extremely reluctant to do anything with the article on the judiciary, to change it, to reform it. A lot of the hostility to a constitutional convention among lawyers is because of this. And the reasons, they're not just because of what's written there. They're because of historical traditions that have grown up around it. One of the strongest examples I can think of, and this means that changes, anytime you change the language of the judicial article, your changes are going to go a lot beyond what you can anticipate, because you're going to be changing all sorts of historical traditions and personal relationships, political relationships that you can't think of when you're changing the words. You just can't think of them all. One of the best examples and clearest examples is the Judicial Council. I don't think there's any inherent reason, from the way the article on the Judicial Council is written, for it to have worked as well as it has. It's seven people, three lawyers appointed by the bar, three non-lawyers appointed by the governor, and the chief justice. Now, those three non-lawyers serve for 6 years, and they don't necessarily coincide. In fact, they don't coincide with the governor's term, and that does prevent them from just being the political toadies of the governor to do what he tells them to do. However, it could certainly serve as a little clique or faction influenced by politics, corruption, or just influenced by friendship and a buddy system. It doesn't. It doesn't serve that way at all. It's a serious body, highly respected among virtually all the people in the state who know anything about it. It's done a great job of screening out duds and keeping them from getting on the bench. And I think the reason is, number one, it has a tradition of trying to do a serious job and not just elevating buddies. It's something that people on there happen to believe in, and when a new man comes on, if he had any other ideas, he learns very quickly to be embarrassed to have them because of the men who are already on the Judicial Council. Another reason is the bar poll. As I suggested before, I think the only people who really know anything about the courts are those who have some reason to be in them. And that's mostly lawyers and judges, of course, who know their own court, and possibly courts below them that have appeals taken to them. The Judicial Council polls the bar on people who've applied to be judges, and they do not follow the bar poll blindly, but they do consider it and treat it with some respect. I think this is very important because there's no constitutional command that they poll the bar. There is no constitutional requirement that they pay any attention to the bar poll. I do not think the Judicial Council would be a successful body without the bar poll. I think that they would not succeed in screening out duds and nominating good men. In order to have a very low number of people rating you unqualified and a very high number of people rating you qualified or well qualified, if you apply for the bench, you have to be a pretty good lawyer, a pretty honest lawyer, and a man whose judgment is pretty generally respected. And there is one way to find out if a person is like that, and that's the bar poll. But it's an historic tradition that is not constitutionally required at all. Any kind of tampering with the judiciary article would likely have an impact on historical traditions that have grown up around it. That would be an unanticipated impact, and since we have such a tremendously successful judiciary in this state at this time, and it's working so well, I think most people familiar with it would be extremely conservative about any kind of tampering with the article. I'd like to open this up at this time for questions and also for comments, because we have two delegates to the Constitutional Convention that I see right in front of me, Judge Buckler, Mr. Nuland, and three, I'm sorry. And I'd like to open it up for comments as well as questions at this time.
I just have a comment going back to...
Perhaps you could state your name and you can state your comments too.
Maynard Lundberg, I'm a delegate from UNOCLEAT, and particularly interested in taking off on your remarks, Mr. Hipler, the problems out in the bush. And I recall living there a number of years ago when we had no legal system, particularly out in the villages. And then under late Judge Hodge, I was appointed United States Commissioner. I've had a little experience along that line, realizing some of the problems. One of the things I did appreciate was the fact that he took the time to work with me as far as at least basic training and preparation for this type of work. One of the things that we worked out under his direction was traveling to the various villages. I don't know where he got his funds, his some fund C that he had, but he made it possible that I could travel with the United States Marshal to the various villages, and thus working with the councils that you mentioned, and trying to come up with probably more of a community decision rather than just moving in and this is what I think and this is the sentence because I'm the law. And I guess I have a lot of respect for this type of judicial system where it isn't possible to move down and have full-fledged judges all the way down. And this is one of the reasons, I think, that those of you that were on the Judiciary Committee made it possible for other judges in other courts with qualifications as prescribed by law, which meant that they did not have to be lawyers. I don't think we had any lawyers living out in within a radius of several hundred miles. And I wonder if we don't need to be a bit patient with the process that is going on right now with the magistrates that are working and possibly with a system of education for them. We're getting more college graduates out in the bush now that certainly would have basic qualifications as far as getting a grasp of the legal proceedings and so forth. I realize that this does not constitute full law training, but I also think of another area of service where we can run a comparison. There were no doctors out there, but we were really happy when a nurse showed up in a village. And my wife was a nurse in a village, and certainly not qualified as a doctor, but believe me, very much appreciated. And I wonder if in this transition period, we don't need to really do all we can to work with the magistrate system until such a time that the population would warrant it, funds would warrant it, when the higher system can move on into the villages.
I think that your remarks are really good on this. I'm really glad that you raised them, Mr. Lombard, because it's nice to have somebody in the audience who actually was involved in the administration of Bush justice at an earlier time. I would only disagree to this extent that I think that the question of having patience with the struggles that people are having in Bush communities to establish a good Bush justice system, I mean, there's no question that of course one has to have patience. But I think you're going to have a lot of patience because your other example of, say, medical practitioners is an excellent one to build from. There is no evidence at all presently that we're ever going to have an Alaska Native physician within the next 10 years. There's no obvious evidence of that. It could happen. It's certainly not going to happen in the next 6 years because we know that there's nobody in a pre-med or med program yet now, right?
No.
No, an Alaska Native?
Yes.
Well, is there one now?
Yes.
Well, good. Okay, then that shows you where we're at. We're talking now about the point in time in which we can talk about one person. You see, we don't know whether he's going to want to practice medicine in Waterbury, Connecticut, or whether he's going to want to come up here. And he has a complete, or he or she has a complete right to do whatever they want. Well, if we were talking about a point that we had reached where there were 20 potential people in that situation, then we're no longer really worried too much. And, you know, some of the slack has been picked up in medical care in a village by the medical health aid, you know, the local indigenous population who is continuously on the phone or on the radio telephone to the hospital in Anchorage for specific information about specific things to be done, and whose training has been limited essentially to first aid. Even a registered nurse, I shouldn't say even, any registered nurse has substantially more medical training than anybody or any sum total of people who are presently nurses, health aides in villages. But I don't think that a registered nurse is a poor example of a sub-professional. A registered nurse is a medical professional, period. But when we're talking about the justice system, we're talking about other things entirely. We're talking about totally sub-professional or paraprofessional people. You know, of course one has to limit it to some extent and buttress it with other institutions, say, such as conciliation boards and that, but I see these as very limited and short-term, and I now fear there's a possibility they may become institutionalized for political reasons well beyond the point at which they're serving a useful function simply for political reasons. And I think it would be a disaster, because I think it is infinitely more important to begin to provide real quality legal care to people in such communities, even as the way the public health service provides medical care.
One little comment on that. No, I follow your line of reason on it. And when I say patience, that may not be the best word, but a transition period, we don't know how long it will be until a system can move down. And when I use the term registered nurse, I perhaps should have taken it a step or two further down to the nurse's aides out in the villages. And here I can cite a recent example. One of my daughters is in a residency program and affiliated with the clinic in Nome just a month ago, and went out to a small village and practiced or held clinic, and came back very impressed with what the nurse's aide was doing and the grasp that this young lady had as far as problems in the village, medical problems. Now, there would be really a paraprofessional or one who had very, very little training. And yet, out of necessity, she is doing her work as a nurse's aide. And I, until there's something better that can just fall in on these villages, I would feel that at least it's a step in the right direction to make it possible through the system that we have, the magistrates and the like. But I would certainly encourage all the training that would be possible for them to receive.
I would, Tim.
Thanks. Does anyone else have questions or comments they'd like to raise? Mr. Nerland?
I'm Leslie Nerland. I was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. And I recall that shortly after the Constitution was written and before it was approved by the electorate, at least one attorney, local attorney here in Fairbanks, and I think maybe two or possibly three, might have come to me and objected to the manner that we had decided the judges should be selected. And this one particular one I'm thinking of is still in practice here in Fairbanks, and he felt very definitely that election was the best system to select our judges. I'm just wondering if attorneys general share your view, Mr. Kleinfeld, as to that this system is effective and good.
My guess, Millard, is that about 90% of attorneys would agree with me that we should stick with the present system and that it's working really well. Would you say that?
The figure I had in mind. I mean, never having taken a poll, I think it's a very small minority of judges, a very small minority of lawyers, perhaps judges too, that would ever be in favor of going to an elected system.
I can think of a couple of lawyers who'd probably get to be judges if we had an elected system, and they don't have a chance of getting past the bar poll and getting through the judicial council.
Well,
but most attorneys are really pleased with the system, I think. Do you think so too, Peter?
I think that whenever you go outside, particularly in the state of Washington, and you see those ads for judges, elect so-and-so an attorney to the Supreme Court, he'll get those criminals and things like that, and or promises by attorneys that when they're elected as judges, they're going to take some particular position or lean one way or clean up the mess or keep up the good work. It's extremely embarrassing, and the idea of attorneys are going to run for judges, then they're going to have campaign funds, then we're going to have to pick our friends and contribute. And then what happens when we appear in court with a client and we strongly oppose the guy who just got elected? Every time you go outside, I just pick Washington because they're having campaigns and you see the people's pictures on the back of a smelly bus. It just seems to be an extremely embarrassing and just hopeless system of producing competent people who can then go on to be impartial. Maybe it works.
I sure hate for the lawyer on the other side to have been the major contributor to the fellow's campaign fund.
I was just going to, just one comment. Not only those, the ones that do want elected judges, my opinion is, and not only include those that want to be judges themselves, but those who do not want an impartial judiciary. And I'm not naming any names, but lawyers who have argued for elected judiciary want an elected judiciary because they feel that they can influence the judges that can get elected, and therefore their clients can get a better deal. They do not want an impartial judiciary. They want a judiciary that's partial for their position.
I was going to add to that I think that that even though it's been pointed out that the present retention vote system doesn't really remove very many people, that isn't as bad a sign as you might think, any more than, say, the fact that only 50% of people vote in an election is considered to be a terrible sign by some people. I think it's an excellent sign. Apathy of that nature in a situation in which people have the freedom to act differently is an excellent sign that they're reasonably comfortable. And when people hear a great deal of disaffection about the courts and that, that's not really quite so. What you're really getting is some disaffection with what is perceived as systemic processes, not directly related to any particular judge or another so much, as systemic processes that seem somehow or another to be freeing criminals to the street or something. This is a more serious concern that many people have. But I don't believe that, except in the minds of some commentators on television, is this really reflective of a, quote, distrust of the judiciary? I don't run into these things that other people claim they run into so much. But I think that it's an excellent sign when people are somewhat apathetic about the judicial process.
Are there any other comments or questions that people would like to make?
Yes, I just want to take one moment longer. And that is as far as the training process. Education is a long process. And when I think of the medical profession, there is one young man who graduated from college last year. I understand he's on the campus here now and hopes to get into medical school next year. Now, I realize that's just one. But if I look back, not too many years ago, we had no teachers among the natives who were qualified through the regular process. Now, I can think of several who are teaching out in the bush areas, if you want to still call the regions out there with that name, who graduated high school, college, fully qualified. And this is within the last 20 years. We started a high school in 54 in Unalakleet, and some of the graduates are back teaching in the various villages now. But that, when I look back, that's over 20 years ago, and looking back on it then, 20 years seemed like a long time. But I think in 20 more years, we're going to see great strides ahead along these other lines, too.
What can I respond?
Justice Rabinowitz?
In regard to the whole rural problem, bringing judicial services or implementing the Constitution, now you can read this Constitution. The Constitution is neutral. In the famous Plessy versus Ferguson line, which was lifted from the attorney's brief, the U.S. Constitution is colorblind, so is ours, as far as that. All persons are entitled to equal protection and rights under the law. This is what your founding fathers said. There's no distinction that people in geographically separated areas of the state or culturally different traditions are entitled to less than full rights under the law. And that's where the tension occurs. Are we going to send out less than, give them less than constitutional judicial services? Well, the answer is maybe it is stopgap, maybe it is interim, but we are, we have an intensive training program for our lay judges. But lurking in the background are constitutional decisions of two major states which have held that a person is denied constitutional rights if he is sentenced by a non-law-trained judge. But we haven't gotten that problem at the Supreme Court level. That's in the background. In the interim, we are doing everything possible to educate and fill in the gaps of our white as well as native magistrates. These are the non-attorney judges. I just think it's a terribly difficult problem. We could spend the next 3 hours talking about how we should solve bringing judicial services to the bush, but we are not standing still. We are even thinking of a certification program that the state of Idaho has just done this with their non-attorney magistrates, or equivalent of our magistrates, where the magistrate's jurisdiction is increased if he can pass certain law tests after law training and law courses, almost the equivalent of a law school type thing.
Yeah, I have one
Judge
other
Buckley?
Comment to make.
I wonder if you could make it at the mic so it'll come out on the tape.
But the enabling legislation which created the Constitutional Convention, the legislature made every effort to ensure that the delegates, the 55 delegates, that was the number that was selected, would be representative of the whole state, particularly the rural area. And the Congress set up the numbers of the legislature and so forth. But even at that time in our history, 1955, that particular enlightened legislature realized that this constitution was going to have to be written by the people outside of the populated center. That's all I want to say. And I think that was a wise decision.
Are there other comments or questions at this time? If not, would
you let me get a hand back there?
Oh, I'm sorry. Would you come up to the microphone so it'll pick up on the tape?
I'm Pat Ivy. I just wondered if the new program or recent program that the judicial system has come up with, reducing the scholastic requirements for a lawyer to pass the bar examination in Alaska, is that aimed directly at upgrading the judicial system in the bush? What is it, 4 years of schooling, a year of law school, and then is it 3 years of clerkship?
I thought it was aimed at getting a particular legislator's friend a law license.
That is not a judiciary-sponsored piece of legislation, and I hope the lawyers give you their reaction. We didn't sponsor that, we didn't ask for any of that type of legislation.
Are you opposed to this program?
I am. But it's not a constitutional issue, I don't think. It's a legislative issue. But I'm definitely opposed to the clerkship program.
We discussed this in our research on Bush Justice 2 and came out very strongly opposed to the idea. Well, I never even raised it because of that.
I think I'd be happier with lawyers who hadn't gone to law school at all than I would be with lawyers who'd done a year there and then dropped out. The lawyer who hasn't gone at all, you know, he's probably from a time when a lot of lawyers didn't and it wasn't as important, or he had other things in his life, like maybe running his gas station. But the lawyer who dropped out after a year, maybe couldn't make it there. My understanding of the historical origins of that, I asked some of the people who are lobbying on it about it, and my understanding is that a particular legislator had a friend who had dropped out of law school and he wanted in the worst way to be a lawyer. We had these bills introduced for, he will be now, I guess. We've had these bills in the worst introduced for years, similar ones, to get particular people's wives in who are doing a lot of work in their law office and all sorts of things like that. I know whenever we lawyers oppose them, we're accused of elitism and trying to keep a monopoly, though. I think we actually live in something as close to Adam Smith's model of pure competition as anybody in the way we do business. It'll just be more crummy lawyers for people to hire, I think. I think most lawyers would share that view.
Well, then, is this panel of the opinion that until such time as we can raise qualified Native or qualified Bush people to act as lawyers, to act as judges, that we should continue to send them to Anchorage or wherever they have to go?
Natives are just as smart as whites. There's nothing about being a Native that means you're not smart. There's no reason why a Native can't go to law school and do just as well there as a white. Not every Native, not every white. But certainly they're now beginning to rise through the educational system. Now there's some problem because the opportunities for Natives who aren't lawyers are so great that it must be awfully tempting to stay in the state and take advantage of them. But I don't see any reason why the highly able Native young people that we're now having graduating from college can't go to good law schools and become good lawyers instead of getting in a back door, which I don't think was put there to be open for Natives.
Furthermore, I'd like to say, I think that if they do go to law school, that doesn't guarantee they're going to go back to the bush. I think what she's talking about, how do you get justice to the bush. No, I don't think that you should have to bring them into Anchorage, like you said, and I think everybody's talked about this. I think that what we've been talking more about is how to get them from, say, the urban areas, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, where have you, out to the bushes, what they call in other states, riding circuit, you know, get out to the villages. But I think, as different people have said here, I don't think to get justice in the bush, it's necessary to put some sort of judicial officer in every village. I think you can have them in more centralized areas and then traveling to the different villages. Mr. Lonberg talked about that. I think that's the way to get justice to the bush, rather than putting unqualified people in a judicial position.
There's an even probably stronger argument against assuming that it's better to have people from a particular ethnic or local community as judges and so forth. Our whole experience in the whole Anglo-Saxon legal tradition has been to recognize that there's a greater and greater need for objectivity in dealing in a court. We get very nervous when the judge is related to the defendant anywhere else. We don't feel you're supposed to take into account peculiarities of attitude and peculiarities of eye color and so forth when you're dealing in a legal case. And the argument that one should wait until or try to upgrade artificially, wait until people from a community are ready to be attorneys or upgrade artificially people in a community to make them judges, just flies in the face of everything we know about what makes a good judicial system, and seems to be a 180-degree reversal of all of the gains we've made over the hundreds of years of moving in the direction of objectivity and civil liberties. I think it's a disastrous step. I would be very much against it.
Thank you very much.
Would other people like to make comments or questions? Would any members of the panel like to comment further? I assume that what I said must have conflicted with what Justice Rabinowitz thinks on some of these issues.
Mr. Kleinfeld, I got one question.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm a prosecutor for the state of Alaska, and I try cases in the bush. And my question to you, you don't convey to me that there was any social order prior to, say, the Coast Guard Cutter Bear. I get a sense when I try a case in the bush that there is a social order, and that we are imposing our system on that order.
Yes, there is a social order, and it's 70 years old. You see, the thing is that you're responding to a fact of social order which is at least two or three generations old. That's long enough to have it been established. But no, prior to the initial coming of U.S. Marshals and the Coast Guard Cutter Bear, no adjudicative process is any more formal than public attitudes expressed in gossip ever worked. And that didn't work on anybody who didn't want it to work. The only ways in which people could respond to frightening or dangerous or murderous activity by their neighbors were they either acquiesced in it, they ran away, or they got together and killed the guy. And there are many examples of this. I mean, this isn't bizarre. The literature is very full. There was, in fact, nothing remotely resembling an adjudicative system. And to the extent there was social control, it was very informal, very weak, very tenuous, and based primarily on the muscle that you could bring to bear yourself to protect your own interests.